on this episode of Edge of the Web.
The data show that depending on what kind of company you are, word of mouth influences between 50 and 91% of all sales. Yet, nobody has a strategy for it. Like, you got a desk full of strategies, right? You got a marketing strategy, a content strategy, a social strategy, a PR strategy, an SEO strategy. You got a HR and recruiting strategy. You got all these strategies. But the one thing you don't have a strategy for is word of mouth.
Your weekly digital marketing trends with industry trend-setting guests. You're listening and watching Edge of the Web. Winners of Best Podcast from the Content Marketing Institute for 2017. Here and see more at edgeoftheweb.com. Now, alongside Tom Broadbeck, here's your host, Aaron Sparks.
All right. Hey, we're back again, broadcasting from Edge Media Studios, downtown Indianapolis, Indiana. Every week, we bring you the latest cutting-edge news from the... See what I did there?
I did. I
probably shouldn't call attention to the pun, should I? It kind of fails the pun there.
It does.
Every week, we're bringing you what's going on in the digital marketing front, as well as talking to marketing influencers from around the planet. Check out all the recent shows over at edgeofthewebradio.com. We also have our video, as well as all the news stories that we bring to you. We're powered by Site Strategics, the title sponsor of the show, who are digital marketing pioneers focused on the agile marketing method. So if you're interested in what that means and what it means to your potential digital success, give us a shout at 877-SEO for web or 877-736-4932. Happy to spend an hour on the phone with you or a Zoom session or Skype to be able to sit down and kind of unpack some of your digital marketing assets and see what could possibly be tweaked in your favor. So give us a shout over at sitestrategics.com. I'm your host, Aaron Sparks, the founder and CEO of Site Strategics. We really appreciate you listening and joining us here every week, and we couldn't do this without feedback from our audience. We'd love to be able to connect with you. And, you know, we're continually bringing you some great influencers from around the planet. So if you have ideas of who we should be interviewing, just give us a shout. We'd love to find out more from you guys. I'm in studio here with Tom Broadbeck, Director of Digital Media.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
I'm very good, sir. How about yourself?
Been good. I thought I said been better, but
been good. You know, don't raise the bar too high. I mean, just kind of go. You know,
it's been a day. It's been a week, to say the least.
There's been a lot of activity here in the studio this week, hasn't there?
It has.
And we are very blessed to be able to have that. Hey, you know, we always dive in to the news, but we first want to introduce our guest. He's a return guest. We got Jay Bear on the line. Jay, how are you doing?
What is up, gents? Great to be back. Nice to see you. Congratulations on your big award as well. You may know that my podcast, Social Pros, won the Content Marketing Institute Best Podcast Award in 2015. So we have that going for us,
there we
guys.
Go.
We'll have a cocktail of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I like the way you think, Jay. I appreciate it. And we love your podcast. It is fantastic.
Thank you.
No, not a problem whatsoever. Well, we brought you on board because we know you just launched a brand new book, and we really want to unpack that. But we want to get your take
news.
On some...
We need the news.
The guy in the news. News. All right. Let's jump into that. Let's take you through the latest digital marketing news.
I was very excited to start my reportings.
This week's trending topics.
All right. Yeah, here's the news. And, you know, I was always wondering when I was actually going to say this on the podcast. But according to Engadget, from Swapna Krishna.
Is that what you...
Swapna Krishna. All right. That's not what I was trying to say. All right. But this is the news story here. Google is shutting down Google Plus following massive data exposure. My gosh. We knew you just a small amount of time in Google Plus. What do we do? What can we say here, Tom?
Yeah, so apparently earlier this week, Wall Street Journal broke a story, and Google announced that they were going to shut down the Google Plus for consumers. They're still going to leave it open for like internal use. The article said, but according to a blog post, 90% of the Google Plus user sessions for last less than 5 seconds. And so, in light of the security concerns with Google Plus's API. The company just opted to put it out of its misery over the next 10 months rather than try to make the social network more secure.
They're going
to
go old Yeller on Google Plus.
Over 10 months. So just a slow...
Yeah, exactly. Extracting the most pain out of that. Wow, my gosh. Well, Google Plus was a place where we as SEOs thought, hey, we got to go play in that sandbox. But my gosh, as it came down, only Google employees ended up using Google Plus. Jay, tell us your Google Plus stories.
Number one, does Google not know how domain forwarding works? Like, why is this a 10-month project? I understand. Like, couldn't we just say Google Plus now resolves to Google.com and we could have this thing shut down?
It's in, a simple 301. Let's go.
Five seconds. But the thing that really amazed me, if you looked at the article there that you guys had on screen, it had 9,623 shares of the article about Google Plus shutting down, which is more shares than anything ever got on Google Plus. So this... That's the great irony of all this, right? Yeah. The news, its obituary is the most popular thing ever. look, but you know, I think that my friend Mark Schaefer wrote a terrific post this week about Google Plus and its demise. And he predicted it from Jump Street, from the first days, like it's not going to make it, it's not going to make it. And he was not alone in that philosophy, but there's a lot of folks who are very bullish on Google Plus, not just in the SEO community, but in other communities as well. Mm-hmm. Mark's point then, and he reiterated it this week, is that, you know, it just wasn't a different mousetrap. Like there wasn't enough of a differentiator between what Google Plus was doing and what Facebook was doing at the time to say, well, let me change all my behaviors to go over there. And as you guys know, a lot of people who, even on the brand side, who were producing content on Google Plus were doing it for the perceived organic search benefit. And I think that even the jury's a little still out whether that was even true. But there was a lot of people who said, well, we don't really see any compelling reason to be on this platform. But if it's going to help us with organic search engine rankings, well, sure, we'll put some stuff on that platform. And that's not a compelling strategic mission.
No, it's not. And I mean, it's understood that whenever Google says dance, we dance. It's their sandbox. And we all thought, especially with the author tags at the time, be able to post inside of Google Plus and be able to have it attributed back to the site, that there was a connection there. And, you know, Google wants us to play with its toys, right? AMP. It looked good from an additional scoring point, but you're right. There was no uniqueness to this thing. Yeah. There was nothing. And they moved things around so much that there was no standard UI that you could count on either.
Yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, Jay, do you think in this climate and where we kind of been in social media the last couple of years, will a new social media network rise up, or will it be, if it starts to rise out, was this Facebook or somebody just buy them out?
Those are two different questions.
Okay.
Do I think there's room in the market? Yeah. Yes, and more than ever. Mm-hmm. I think we're already seeing Facebook and its popularity wane a little bit. The numbers bear that out. They have somewhat of a reduction in usage for the first time ever earlier this year. You see a lot more people moving over to Instagram because it's certainly simpler to use. And I think some people perceive it to be a more positive platform, maybe, you know, less sort of fighting and things along those lines. So I do think there is an opportunity for something else. And I wouldn't maybe have said that always, but I certainly say that this year. The second question that you raise is particularly interesting, that if somebody gets a foothold, can they survive as an independent company? Sure, you can. It just, the question is, you know, will your investors let you do that? Like any new social network that comes on the scene that gets big enough to be a real challenger to Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, et cetera, is only going to be able to do that with a tremendous amount of venture capital behind them. Venture capital organizations are not really driven by the need to let's go it alone and let's make sure that we have an alternative to Facebook. They're trying to develop and produce a return for their shareholders.
Yep.
And if Facebook comes along and says, okay, here's 28 times your investment, we'd like to buy you now, it's a pretty unusual set of circumstances where somebody says no. The only thing we've seen along those lines in recent history that we're aware of is Snapchat, right? Yeah. Snapchat said no because the way their debt structure was, they didn't have that as much pressure from venture capitalists to flip the deal. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the bigger issue, is that you know, the economics of getting big almost make it impossible to stay independent.
Well said. You know, the only additional wild card is the consumer base really wanting some diversification. It is that they're sick and tired of feeding from the same trough and also, you know, getting exploited. I mean, there is a pendulum swinging to more simple platforms. And these micro platforms are really spaces where, I mean, they're starting to take off and the loyalty is really, really deepening. Quora is a perfect example of that. So, yeah. You know, the social,
well, you know, WhatsApp, right, WeChat, right. Outside the U.S., certainly Facebook Messenger, mm-hmm. This idea that interaction kind of goes recursive back to the old days where it's more of a phone book driven model and less of a broadcasting model. And so you're communicating to 2, 3, 4, 6 people, as opposed to however many people you can aggregate for your particular post. I certainly see more people headed that direction. In fact, I'm sure you guys are familiar with this. You know, in my world, a lot of people, and I don't mean like a few, I mean a lot, say that the only thing they actually like about Facebook is Facebook groups, right? That Facebook newsfeed is just, you know, nonsense. And what they really like is the group side mm-hmm. of it, which is that more intimate, personalized, relevant set of behaviors. Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. And that itself could spawn that type of collective closed door social media connectivity. You're absolutely right. Speaking of Facebook, from Recode, Kurt Wagner and Randy Mola writes, Facebook will soon rely on Instagram for the majority of its ad revenue. Instagram's founders depart. Execution can't skip a beat, so says the article. So when Instagram founders Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger announced last month they were stepping away from Facebook, there was a collective gasp. Instagram's future was actually at risk. But as the article goes through, Facebook's acquisition of Instagram has been a total success, one of the biggest in the internet era. The app, which Facebook acquired for $1 billion in 2012, now has more than a billion users and should generate $8 to $9 billion in revenue this year alone, depending on whose estimates you use. Other achievements are harder to measure, like how Instagram reduced Snapchat as a strategic threat by cloning many of its features. So, what we're looking at here is Facebook's ad business has been growing rapidly over the years and has helped it become one of the most valuable companies. But it has also been warning for 2 years that its revenue growth would start to slow. And when that happens, Instagram will have to drive the next phase of growth. You can see some of the charts here on the screen. And audio listeners, but you can certainly see it in the show notes. Last quarter, Instagram generated an estimated $2 billion, or about 15% of Facebook's $13 billion in ad revenue, according to estimates from Andy Hargraves, a research analyst from KeyBank. You know, Instagram is also incredibly important on Facebook's future, and Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg are now under the pressure to make sure their prize acquisition doesn't go off the rails with its co-founders out of the building. So what we're seeing here is a doubling down on Instagram, and we've seen just from advertising the reaction of the community inside of Instagram. There is a heck of a lot of engagement that's happening on the Instagram side that we hadn't even seen on Facebook for a long time. So, Jay, what are your thoughts in this space regarding Facebook doubling down and really using Instagram as the cash cow?
Well, you don't really have any other choice. Facebook newsfeed, there aren't any more places to put ads. you can only squeeze so much blood from a stone, and that's really where they're at. I think it's important to note in that article, they're not suggesting that Instagram is the majority of ad revenue. They're suggesting that Instagram is the majority of ad revenue growth, which is not the same thing.
No, you're right? Absolutely right.
You know, Facebook is going to be here, and it's going to be here-ish forever, mm-hmm. or for the foreseeable future. Instagram is the only thing they have that can do this, and it has to do this. My concern is Instagram will eventually have the same problem, right? They will have reached maximum number of ad insertions on that platform and in stories as well. And so then what, right? Like how many more ads can you can you insert in the Instagram feed before people say, hey, enough is enough? So I'm a little bit skeptical about Facebook's ability to continue to put up the kind of ad growth trajectory that they have historically, because they've almost reached sort of maximum penetration, right? There's not that many more people with electricity that they can find. and on the Facebook newsfeed side, they're starting to kind of slow and cap the revenue there. Instagram has some headroom for sure, but not that much. So then what becomes the next growth engine after Instagram? That, I think, is the more interesting question, is that once Instagram tops out, what's next? Is it WhatsApp? But is that monetizable in the same way? I'm not sure. But as somebody who does, disclosure, own Facebook stock, I wonder what that looks like 2 years down the road.
Are we beginning to see the growth expectations shorten by the consumer's pushback in these different spaces, because we're all getting saturated with all these ads? And what you're explaining is they are kind of chasing us everywhere that we finally camped out and engaged. All of a sudden it's monetized and we're just saturated with it. Are we going to start seeing, not only are we going to start seeing a growth trajectory that's a higher growth trajectory, but a shorter growth trajectory until the consumers just bail on that platform?
It would stand to reason, right? Yeah. That things will get popular faster and will be abandoned faster for that reason. What's interesting about Facebook, though, is all the research that I've seen this year, some of the we've performed, some from Edison, some from Pew, from other sources, suggest that despite the fact that you know they have kind of reached maximum ads, that part doesn't really drive people out. And just anecdotally, you don't hear that, at least I don't, from friends. They don't say, you know what I don't like about Facebook? It's too many ads. People dislike the general tone and tenor of Facebook and its sort of role as central to our lives, and now the data breach and things like that. But I don't hear a lot of complaints about too many ads. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's causing people to flee yet. But I think as a practical matter, there's only so many more ads they can insert.
I think we're just numb to the fact.
Yeah. Mid-roll ads would be like the only complaint I have on Facebook ads.
The mid-rolls?
Yeah. Mid-roll ads are the worst.
Yeah. And same thing with YouTube. Yeah, that annoys me as well. Sure.
Oh, what a great segue from Marketing Land with Greg Sterling. There's an estimate video now is 25% of all digital advertising. Facebook is the top site in this. Facebook roughly has two times the video. What in the world am I reading here? Facebook roughly two times of video of YouTube when looking at net video revenue, according to eMarketer. My God, I was trying to get that thing out. So what we're dealing with here is, according to eMarketer's newest forecast, online video ad spending in the U.S. will reach $27.8 billion. Accordingly, it will also constitute one quarter of all U.S. digital advertising. This has been an explosion for the last 2 to 3 years here. Video's just been running rampant, and micro video formats have truly taken over. But the Facebook, the breakdown here of how video represents itself and inside of different ad revenues, Facebook and Instagram, $6.1 billion, YouTube, $3.36 billion, Twitter, $633 million, Snapchat, $397 million. So you're absolutely right. Facebook is twice the amount of revenue that YouTube video ads are running. So, Jay, what's your thoughts in the video ad realm? We're talking about ad saturation. We're talking about so many different areas of just seeing video ads everywhere. We've got the mid-rolls that are getting more and more annoying. They're abusing us with video now, but it's successful, is it not?
Well, so far it is. Yeah. I mean, we do a lot of ad testing of this this regard, and certainly video ads tend to outperform non-video ads, at least at this point. That may not be the case forever. I think it's another interesting example, though, of Facebook kind of outflanking Google. I mean, how many years of head start did YouTube had? Facebook only added video ad units, right? Not that long ago, like 2-3 years ago or something like that, right? And now it's, you know, whatever that number of $6 billion or something. They just like invented a $7 billion
overnight,
seemingly overnight. So YouTube's got to be kicking themselves a little bit. Like, hey, how come that's not our number? But the other thing I find a little bit troubling is to get gigantic, right, even more gigantic than it already is, you have to start tapping into more and more small businesses. Course, this has been the secret of Google search and SEM forever, right? It's not just big businesses. It's driven largely by smaller and medium-sized businesses. Mm-hmm. What concerns me a little bit about this video ad revolution, though, is does it leave the small guy behind? Like, can the small business credibly create a video ad in the same way that they can credibly create a paid search ad? I don't know about that, and we'll see. That's why there's a lot of technology out there trying to make video ad creation simple for the small guy. I don't think any of those companies has a real leading position yet in that market. But I think it's going to be required for Facebook via Instagram, even Snapchat, et cetera, to say, hey, let us help you produce video ads if you don't have somebody on your team
right. Who
can actually execute on it. It's easy for big companies. It's easy for you and for me, people who have teams to do this. But if you're a local business and you're like, yeah, you got to make a video ad for Facebook and then a different formatted one for YouTube and then a different formatted one for Snapchat. So like, yeah, screw it. I'm out.
And then you have to also test and have different factors. Yeah. There's no place for the small businesses to be able to jump in there and really get the success that you can get from video ads without somebody being able to shepherd that.
And if you go to the Facebook ad manager, you want to send a small business owner screaming out of the room, log into a Facebook ad manager and say, this is how you manage your ad campaign now.
Yeah. Yeah, you better believe it. And they're moving it all over the place. I mean, literally, you'll go in there at one point in time, and two of the controls that you had are over here or disappeared off the dashboard altogether. Not to gripe about that, but you're absolutely right. So Facebook did roll out their ad templates that are the interstitials inside of the ad or the app itself, and it's very easy to customize those for that small business user, right?
That's going to be the key. Making it easy. It ultimately has to be DIY, right? That's the genius, and has always been the genius of paid search, you know, going all the way back to the go-to days and things like that I used to buy in 1995, that you could credibly DIY it, right? Mm-hmm. You needed a login and a credit card and the ability to write two lines of not terrible copy. And we have to continue to allow that DIY to work in order to reach enough businesses for this growth to continue. Because at some point it just peters out if it's only companies of a certain size.
Absolutely. Wow. Very good. All right. Well, video ads are the space. I tell you what's really easy to be able to manipulate is signing up for our newsletter. It's so simple. Anybody can do it. Jump over to edgeofthewebradio.com. You can submit your information right there. Your email is all we need, and we're going to be sending you nuggets of gold like this interview. Well, we haven't had the interview yet, so I'm forecasting. But also who we've talked to in the past, as well as the different news items that we're talking about regularly. Get it into your inbox on a regular basis. We won't use your email for anything else, but sending our newsletter out. And you can also text to the number 228-28, the word Edge Talk, and sign up right there. So we want to make sure we cover all the trending topics. Go check it out over at Edge of the Web Radio. But now let's deep dive with this week's featured guest.
Now it's time for Edge of the Web featured interview with Jay Baer, author of the new book, Talk Triggers.
I love the mugshot there, Jay. Hey, to our audience who hasn't heard of Jay Baer, shame on you. You should know the name. He's been around for over 25 years in digital marketing and consumer experience marketing.
Yeah, I've been around for 49 years. Let's just make that right. Marketing for 25 years. Yeah,
over half of his life, he's been in digital marketing.
God, that's true. Jesus, I've never thought that before.
Yeah, it just kind of came home, didn't it?
Yeah, that really, I'm going to have to go get a, oh God.
Wow, okay. Well, I mean, we can both commiserate, but it's quite depressing to think about. Anyway, he's actually marketed for more than 700 companies, including 34 in the Fortune 500. Jay's Convince and Convert blog was named number one content marketing blog, and he also hosts and produces the Social Pros podcast, fantastic podcast if you haven't checked it out. Mm-hmm. He also is the author of six best-selling books, including his most recent books, Hug Your Haters and Utility. as well as Talk Triggers. And Talk Triggers just came out last week, so we had to get Jay on the show to talk about this show about the book. You can talk about the show too. You're more than welcome to. But we really want to hear before anything else your backstory. We always ask, how'd you get to where you are of our guests? So unpack it for us, would you?
God, how long's the show? I started off in politics. I was a political campaign consultant. I ran political campaigns, specialized in direct mail as a young man. Did that for a little bit. Realized that that's not a particularly family-friendly occupation. And got into traditional marketing for a time. Worked for a corporation and did print ads and events and trade shows, and that kind of thing. And then I worked for the government for about 20 minutes as a spokesman. And that was about 19 minutes too long. And I was actually the spokesman for the Department of Juvenile Corrections in Arizona. So my job was to give tours of the juvenile prison system, which is awesome.
That's also family-friendly fun right there.
It's also family-friendly, yeah. And so I went out to dinner with some buddies of mine who had started the very first internet company in Arizona. I'm from Arizona. Originally, I live in Bloomington, Indiana now. And we were out to dinner and they said, you know, we started this internet company and it's getting a little bit bigger and we don't know anything about marketing. And I said, well, that's okay. Because when you say internet, I don't really know what that word means. This was 1993. This is AOL, Prodigy, CompuServe times. And so the open internet was a scary place that you didn't go into unless you were like super nerd. But I said, I will do anything to not give another tour of this prison. And so I walked in and quit. I walked in and quit the next day. And quite literally, the day following, started as the vice president of sales and marketing of an internet company, having never been on the internet, which makes for a super interesting first day at work. I can tell you that for sure. And
the first question is literally, what is it?
Yes. What are we selling in marketing here? Exactly. We ended up growing the company really quickly. Fun fact, I wouldn't say this on all shows, but you guys will appreciate this. My partner in that company invented virtual hosting. So before this, if you wanted to have a website, you had to have an actual box, like an actual server. It was one domain, one server. Mm-hmm. You had to have a rack. Mm-hmm. He invented the partitioning algorithm that allows you to run multiple domains and basically segment off the hard drive to run different websites on one box. He invented it. So for a time, we were literally the only company in the world that could do virtual hosting. So everybody else was charging $1,200 a month for a website, and we were charging $179. And it went like, we had people sleeping on the floor and customers all over the world. It was a crazy time. Mm. We were doing this so early that when I started, domain names were free. You could get whatever domain name you wanted and just say, I'd like to have that, and be like, okay, here you go. And my partners and I sold Budweiser.com to Anheuser-Busch for 50 cases of beer.
No.
True story. And our whole office was full of beer. We had to kick the intern out of his office because he had like a lock on his door. And we filled his office floor to ceiling full of Bud long necks. And we felt like we got a good deal.
How do you feel now, Jay?
Less good now. Then we felt like we really accomplished something. So early days. And so I've only made two good decisions in my whole career. And this is really true. Everything else just stems from these two. One, I convinced my wife to marry me, which required a tremendous amount of time and effort. It was a whole nurture campaign.
That's where you got the chops in marketing right there.
No, there's a lot of truth to that. I've never worked that hard before or since, and I've written 6 books. And the second good thing I did was I got involved in the web, very early, as I just told you. And I've had the good sense to not get uninvolved, right? So I've been in digital marketing since the very beginning. And I've had a series of consultancies that I've started and sold a couple, et cetera. And my current firm, Convince and Convert, as you mentioned in the introduction, works with large brands on digital strategy, word of mouth strategy, content strategy, social strategy. We just celebrated our 10th anniversary a couple of months ago. We're virtual. I've got people all over the country that we get together once a year. And other than that, we meet online, and I love it. It's pretty good. It's a good gig.
Convince and convert to our listeners who haven't checked that out. It's an incredible depth of digital marketing experience, and actually segmented into different types of any level of marketing savviness will be able to learn something mm-hmm. from that blog. In fact, I mean, our team here has been following Convince and Convert for a long time, and some incredible information from a lot of just top-notch influencers. So you've been able to, you're more than welcome, been able to wrangle a lot of good contributors, and that's and the concept of persuasion marketing, right? Convincing and being able to connect with users on their path, and also the other half of the coin, being able to actually process and convert those users. That is the key concept of digital marketing, and you were blazing the trails back then, and we certainly appreciate your continued contribution into this space. Now let's pivot around here to books, because those have also been a huge factor of influencer marketing. And I want to say this is not even, there's something else that's going on here. We as digital marketers literally utilize your books to help educate our clients. One of the key things I've used over the years was the book Utility. Demonstrate. Oh, no, you're more than welcome. Thanks so much. I've closed a few deals because of you. But it's the sheer fact of being useful online and being able to provide consumers information and an experience that they're looking for that will help them in whatever their pursuits are, as opposed to just blaring a megaphone mm-hmm. and hoping that something sticks. So that's a fantastic book. The new book that you've got here, just give us a quick summary of what Talk Triggers is all about here, man.
You know, people have asked me this. Well, Jay, why did you write a book about word of mouth? That doesn't seem very digital, because you're a digital marketing guy, and there is some truth to that. But I all the books that I've written are all tied together this way. So I wrote a book called The Now Revolution, which is about how to use social media to get customers more effectively and more quickly. I wrote Utility, which is about how to use content to get customers more quickly and more effectively. I wrote Hug Your Haters, which is about how to use customer service to get customers more quickly and more effectively. And Talk Triggers is about how to use word of mouth to get customers more quickly and more effectively. So they're all kind of the same in that it's sort of a money ball way mm-hmm. of outflanking your competitors and growing your business. What I love about Talk Triggers and word of mouth is that it is the original marketing. I mean, until we learned how to paint on cave walls, word of mouth was all we had.
Yep. Right?
That was the only marketing tool in the toolbox. And even today, it is so incredibly important, yet totally understudied. So the data show that depending on what kind of company you are, word of mouth influences between 50 and 91% of all sales. Yet nobody has a strategy for it. Like, you got a desk full of strategies, right? You got a marketing strategy, a content strategy, a social strategy, a PR strategy, an SEO strategy. You got a HR and recruiting strategy. You got all these strategies. But the one thing you don't have a strategy for is word of mouth, which is responsible for more customers than all the rest of that stuff. It's because we in business have taken word of mouth for granted. We're so laissez-faire about it. We just assume that our customers will talk about us, but will they? And what are they saying exactly? So what I tried to do with this book, and I wrote it with my good friend Daniel Lemon, is to give people a very specific framework for how to do word of mouth on purpose instead of doing it on accident.
The influence that word of mouth has, that you just that key data point, it's something that's been untapped, and from a word of mouth standpoint, it's also one of the more difficult things to accomplish in all of these different strategies, because you've got, I mean, it really gets down to the core. If you can be advocated by somebody, a consumer, to another consumer, and that's that trust tribe, right? Getting somebody to actually, it's not posting online, it's not sending a review, it's not that transactional side of things that's benefiting that user. That consumer has to be able to speak for you your brand and recommend it, and their own clout's on the line, right? Yeah. Based on that, so it's not only Untappd, it's also pretty darn difficult to get that consumer to be able to talk about you, right?
What we recommend in the book is to create a talk trigger, which is why the book is called Talk Triggers.
Sweet.
And a talk trigger is a strategic operational differentiator that compels word of mouth. It's something that you do differently in mm-hmm. your company that customers notice and talk about, which is great because the best way to grow any business is for your customers to do that growing for you.
Oh, absolutely.
What you want to do is come up with something in the operations that your customers don't expect, and then they will talk about that thing to each other. Most businesses don't do this because we have convinced ourselves incorrectly that competency creates conversation. That just being a good company will cause customers to talk about you. But that doesn't really happen, not in the real world. Like I don't know all of your viewers and listeners. I'm sure I know some of them, mm-hmm. but I know this for a fact. Nobody watching or listening has ever said, hey, let me tell you about this perfectly adequate experience I just had. Like, people don't say that, right? Because right. it's not interesting. It's not a good story. And word of mouth is all about giving your customers a consistent story to tell one another. And so that story isn't typically about quality. It's about something that they didn't expect.
That uniqueness.
So that's
factor.
What we do in this book. Yeah, it's just, and it doesn't have to be hard. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be big. It just has to be something they don't expect.
To double down on that, efficiency of delivery, efficiency of shipping, efficiencies that the businesses strive for because that's what they believe consumers expect. That is that still. I mean, that hasn't gone away. They still have to.
Yeah, no, you should do that. I'm not suggesting. Yeah, absolutely.
No, I'm saying there's still
like. Yeah. Yeah, good customer experience is important, right? And it's really absolutely. Important for customer retention, for sure. But different customer experience is what creates conversation.
Understood. It's even more difficult to be in business now because you have to raise that bar mm-hmm. to efficiency, but you also have to be able to create that uniqueness that people are going to talk about. And we hear these different stories about the personal touches, being able to, thank you notes and, going back to Gary Vee and the thank you economy, those type of connections help, create that unique aha moment, right? So you have an entire series of operational executions to be able to help small businesses create that and personalize it for themselves, right?
Yeah, that's really the way the book is set up. It's in a 4-5-6 system. It includes the 4 ingredients of your talk trigger. It includes the 5 different types of talk triggers, and then a 6-step process that anybody can use to create their own talk trigger. So it's really set up that way that anybody can follow the system, and it's the exact same system, exactly the same that we use at Convince and Convert when we do this work for brands. So we just took how we do it and wrote a book about it. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be hard. I'll give you an example mm-hmm. that I really like. So there's a restaurant in Sacramento, California. It's called Skip's Kitchen. And it's a counter service restaurant, pretty simple. You go to the front and you say, I'd like 2 patty melts and I'd like an order of fries and a chocolate shake. And then when your food's ready, they bring it to your table. We've all been to restaurants like that. Their talk trigger, though, is that before you pay, the counter person whips out a deck of playing cards mm-hmm. and fans them out face down in front of you and says, pick a card. And you pick a card. And if you get a joker, your entire meal is free, whether you are buying just for yourself or for 10 people, your whole family. Now, Skip's has been in business for 10 years. They've spent a grand total of $0 on advertising ever. They were just named the 29th best hamburger restaurant in America by USA Today newspaper. And there's a line to get in almost every day. And it's because on average, about 3 people win this Joker game every day. And when they win, mm-hmm. they go batshit crazy, right? They're like taking patty melt selfies and they're calling their mom and they're telling their friends and they're putting reviews on TripAdvisor and Yelp. high school marching band shows up. It's just a thing, right? And it's so powerful that in Sacramento, despite the fact there's a big neon sign out front that says Skip's Kitchen, most people in Sacramento call it That Joker Restaurant.
Really?
Now, that's not a campaign, right? That's not a stunt. That's not even marketing. That's an operational choice that produces a marketing advantage. And that's how talk triggers work. It's a word of mouth strategy that pays off every day, every week, every month, every quarter, and every year. But it's not walking an elephant through a conference room, right? It's just doing one thing different in the operations of your business that give your customers a story, something to remember that's better than, yeah, it's a good restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it almost connects to, I believe it does, connect to the personality factor of businesses, and customer loyalty is searching for those unique personalities of businesses. That's that one-to-one relationship that's now really becoming the goal of organizations as, you know, through social media, but certainly inside the brick-and-mortar realm. Do you run the risk of looking kitschy by not thinking through the talk trigger and trying to do something that you're not wired to be disciplined about and have that operational mindset? Can it backfire on you?
If you follow the system, no, but the point is very well taken. In the book, we talk about the fact that because talk triggers are by definition operational, you have to have everybody in the organization on the same page. The reality is that marketing often leads these kind of initiatives, but they cannot and should not go it alone. Marketing needs to be working with operations, with sales, with service, with everybody in the organization to make sure that we're all on the same page of the playbook. We also suggest, and in fact, almost demand, that you do not roll out a talk trigger unless you've tested it. So our approach is that you come up with something that you think might work, and we have a whole methodology for how you figure that out, and then you test it. You try it on, depending on your business, you know, every nth customer, or only customers on Thursdays, or only customers in Texas, or only customers who bought this recliner, or whatever your mechanics are, some sort of segmentation study. And then you look for evidence of talkability and chatter amongst that test group. And then if it seems to be working, they're like, aha, then you roll it out to everybody. But you don't just like, okay, you know, show starts now, and just gotta give it a whirl, because you're right, it could totally suck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely, and the discipline side of things, the consistency, whether or not they have that feedback that this is the right path to go down, being able to, again, operationalize it and make sure that they don't go tepid into this and back away, right? They have to buy.
Yeah, especially because when it's inconsistent, it creates a lot of challenges, because when you treat customers inconsistently, it can breed contempt.
Oh.
Not conversation, right? So sometimes, especially today in marketing and in social, this is really common. I'm sure you guys are familiar with this premise of surprise and delight, that you take one customer in one circumstance and you treat them really, really well, in the hope that they'll create content and it will go viral or whatever. Like, hotels do this all the time, right? Like, somebody checks into their hotel room and they look around, there's a live panda bear in the room. There's like a eucalyptus tree. You're like, what the hell? You know, I'm freaking out, right? And then they're like putting it on Instagram, and then it goes on Reddit, and then MSNBC calls or whatever. That can work, right? Like, I get it. Like, that can work, but that's not a strategy. Like, that's not word of mouth strategy. That's a lottery ticket.
Right.
And to me, that doesn't, you can't milk that cow for, 10 years, right? That you milk that cow for a week. That doesn't mean you shouldn't buy that cow. It's just a different cow.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that when you do that on purpose, everybody who checks into the room who doesn't get a panda bear, they're like, hey man, where's my bear? Like, and you're just setting customers up to feel less than. And I got to tell you, as you know, I travel a ton, I speak all over, and I'm at an airport many times every week. And this is where you see it most often, like in the airline boarding process. Like, every airline now, other than Southwest, has 117 boarding groups. Huh. And if you're in group one or two, as I typically am, because I fly so much, I'm like, yeah, baller, right on. but if you're if you're in like group nine and you're getting on the plane and there's like dirty diapers and like ice and like whatever else is getting on with you,
right,
you don't feel good. And now they, it's so bad. They give you like this warning, right? So you're sitting there in the boarding lounge and they're like, welcome to Delta flight 4550, Indianapolis to Detroit. I just want to let you know that if you're in boarding group four or higher, there's no way in hell this bag is getting on the plane. So why don't you just bring it to me right now, and we'll give you a little piece of paper that you'll probably lose, and we'll just call it good, right? And this is their plan. This is their actual customer experience strategy, right? Is to treat people with these tiers of experience, and it sucks, man. It just it's a bad idea, and you shouldn't try your word of mouth the same way, right? Like let's do this crazy stunt for somebody. Like that's not what I'm talking about here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about everybody gets to play the Joker game at Skip's Kitchen. Yep. It's not just ladies' night. It's not just on your birthday. It's not just on Monday night when they're slow. It's every customer every time. And you're right, though. That requires having your shit together on the operations side,
right,
and having the discipline to keep following through. Because if you do the Joker thing for 2 weeks and then you stop because you didn't feel like it one day, the whole thing blows up in your face.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And thank you for illustrating that. And I've experienced that too many times.
Everybody has. It's crazy.
I'm the four group and the five group because you know I'm just cheap that way. But it is arduous. And you create this, they create this resentment of the other guys, the guys in the number ones and number twos. Like, oh, well, I guess they're just a little bit higher on the pecking order than I. I mean, you're having some major social dissonance there.
Yeah, and it's like created on purpose.
Yeah.
That's the part that's such a puzzle to me. I did an event just this week in Las Vegas, and I was speaking to a group of casino owners from all around the world. It was like 30,000 casino owners. And I had this data that I found. It's really interesting, new research from a tourism and hospitality journal that said that loyalty programs have no word of mouth impact. So all the airline loyalty programs, the hotel loyalty programs, certainly the casino loyalty programs have demonstrated impact on customer retention, but they have no impact on word of mouth. So, you know, you're kind of trying to make one thing do two things and can't do that. Right. So a talk trigger and having a word of mouth strategy that every customer gets to access is a better approach. I learned about one. I'll tell you this one because it's not even in the book. This is special just for your audience. Because I learned about this after the book was written. I was in Seattle like 3 weeks ago, and a guy comes up to me after my speech and he says, "Hey, have you heard about this talk trigger?" I'm like, "I don't think so because I don't have any Seattle examples." He's like, "Okay, there's a doctor here in town. He's a surgeon." I'm like, "Go on." "He's a vasectomy surgeon." I'm like, "Okay." "And his name is Dr. Snip." And I'm like, "That's amazing that his name is Dr. Snip." And the guy said, "Yeah, but that's not the talk trigger." I said, "Oh, well, what's the talk trigger?" Every single patient on the way out the door is presented with an engraved silver pocket knife that says on it, "Dr. Snip, vasectomy surgeon." Now you can imagine you're like watching football, you're on your boat, you're playing golf with your friends, and you open a beer or whatever with this thing. And your buddy's like, "Hey man, sweet knife, bro. Where'd you get it?" "Where'd I get it? I got it from Dr. Snip, the vasectomy surgeon." That's gold or silver. At least.
Silver.
I just don't know if I'd be bragging about my vasectomy when I'm bragging a beer, but I get it. Oh, that is too funny.
Think about, okay, like if you've had a vasectomy, who's likely to need a vasectomy? Your guys who are the same age, like all your buddies. Like, you know, you think about birds of a feather, right? It's almost like, I mean.
That's a very niche. And yeah, absolutely. Oh, my gosh. That is hilarious. So you mentioned four requirements to make something a talk trigger, and you got the 4, 5, 6. But can you unpack these briefly?
Yeah, totally.
Excellent. So run us through it real quick.
So four R's, because they all start with R. You see, the first one is your talk trigger has to be remarkable, worthy of remark, because again, this is about customers telling stories to one another. So it has to be a story that's interesting enough to tell. Right. If on the way out the door, the vasectomy surgeon, they gave you a magnet with their phone number on it, you would A, throw it away, and B, not tell anybody.
Right.
It's not remarkable. Okay. Has to be remarkable. Second thing is it has to be repeatable. We talked about that earlier, that your talk trigger has to be given to all customers, not just some. Third is it has to be reasonable. In marketing now, we sometimes convince ourselves that because consumer attention is scarce and hard to come by, that the solution to that is to do something really big, like give somebody a panda bear or have a contest and somebody wins an island or whatever. and that actually, that backfires. It doesn't work because people then are suspicious about the contest itself and you know, it's just untrustworthy. So third R is reasonable. And the fourth one is it has to be relevant. It has to make sense in the context of who you are and what you do. Pocket knife, vasectomy surgeon.
Absolutely.
I get it, right?
Yep.
It's a story that resonates, right? So those are the four R's. And then we have the five types of talk triggers. The first one is the one we've talked about the most because it's the most commonly used. It's the easiest to implement in businesses, and that is talkable generosity. That's when you're more generous than customers expect. So I give everybody a knife. Talkable generosity.
Mm-hmm.
The second one is talkable responsiveness. So you're faster than customers expect. That's what we use at Convince and Convert. So when customers email us, call us, message us, we typically respond in 2 or 3 minutes.
Mm.
We actually staff it 16 hours a day in order to be that responsive to our clients. A third one is talkable usefulness, which is similar to my book, Utility, where you're more useful than customers expect.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that's called talkable empathy, where you're kinder, more human, more warm than customers expect you to be. And the last one is talkable attitude, where you're just a little more wacky than customers expect you to be. Like, you guys might know the company Uber Conference, right? They're a free conference call service.
Yep.
And Uber Conference doesn't do anything different than any of the other conference call services does, except for one thing, their talk trigger.
I know what it is. I know what it is.
Crazy, crazy, hilarious on hold music.
Yep.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
For the first time.
yes. But talkable all the time.
Absolutely. So
that song was created and performed by their CEO. And that is their talk trigger. If you go on Twitter right now and search Uber Conference Plus on hold, you'll see tweet after tweet after tweet after tweet of people saying, I only use this service because the on hold music is so wacky. So that is talkable attitude. So
those are the five. It gets a giggle every time we have a conference.
Every time.
Very good. Very good. So certainly each and every one of these core components have depth in the book and a good number of examples in the book. How does a company, you're giving these steps and these processes of what they should be and this in the descriptions and how they should be executed. Where does a company start even envisioning how they could be could create a talk trigger? I mean, rarely do they introspect themselves of how they could be wacky or how they could be relevant. So can you give us some guiding points there?
Yeah, I'll tell you the worst way to start is to get everybody in a conference room and brainstorm it, which is how everybody thinks they should start. But if it was that easy, you'd have already done it.
Mm-hmm.
So the best place to start and how we recommend doing it in the book is to first create a customer journey map, which identifies all the key touch points that you have with your customers. So think about Dr. Snip. Okay, one of the key touch points is when the patient leaves the office, right? So you would document that on a customer journey map. Once you have the customer journey map created, then what we recommend is you actually conduct 3 sets of customer interviews. Ideally, telephone, could be face-to-face. And you want to interview 5 to 6 of each of these groups. New customers, longtime customers, and lost customers. And those could be customers that you never closed or those that were customers and then bailed.
Mm-hmm.
Now you want to talk to 5 or 6 of each of those. And what you want to do in those interviews is kind of go through that customer journey map and say, what did you expect would happen at each of these points? What you're trying to create is an expectation map amongst your customers. Because once you know what people expect, you by definition know what they don't expect. And the difference between what they expect and what they don't expect is the gold. That's where your talk trigger lies.
Hmm.
And ironically, some of the best talk triggers in the world are those that take something boring, mundane, and perfunctory and put a little twist on it. You guys might know that my business card, my actual J. Bear business card, has for 10 years now been a metal bottle opener. And not a week goes by that somebody doesn't come up to me and say, Jay, I got your business card 7 years ago at a conference and I still have it. It's in my golf bag or it's in my boat. And one of the reasons that's such a good talk trigger is that it takes something that's very, very boring, a business card, mm-hmm. and puts a little twist on it. So that's the best way to start creating your talk triggers, is to figure out what your customers expect and then figure out where you could do something that they don't expect.
There's plenty of mundane issues in anybody's business, and it's ripe for just looking at it that way. How can we make that just a little bit unique? Mm-hmm. And you're looking for a disruptor. That's what you're looking for. Something that,
that's it. Just one thing. Like we talk about in B2B. You guys are in B2B like me. You guys are in the consulting business. We don't do this at Convince and Convert, but I wish we did. I invented this on a conversation I had a couple of days ago. In the consulting space, like one of the key inflection points is you give the customer a proposal, right? So and you might ask your customers in this interview process, what did you expect would happen? And they might say, well, I expected you would make a proposal and you'd save it as a PDF and then you would email it to me, right? That's a fairly typical, certainly mundane and perfunctory way of giving a proposal, but that's kind of how it's done in many cases. Well, guys, what if instead you sent your prospective customer a sheet cake and the frosting of that sheet cake was printed out to look like the cover of your proposal?
That's awesome.
The proposal, the proposal itself was printed on mm-hmm. paper and put into a laminated sleeve that was located underneath the sheet cake. So that in order to actually get your proposal, your prospective customer had to eat an entire cake. Now, would that cause word of mouth chatter? Would that take something
probably
boring?
Probably not, like, because their mouth is full, but...
Right. Good point. Right. But that's what I'm talking. That's absolutely just something very basic. Like, give them a proposal. Well, what if you said, how can we give a proposal in a way that they've never expected?
Yep. Ta-da. Yep. There it is. You have to take time and just preen through your process and know your customer's experience, right? I love it.
That's the key to it. Most of us don't really spend enough time thinking through how the customer views all those touch points. That's why we really recommend that interview process. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how eye-opening that is. It's crazy.
So how do you measure the success of word of mouth marketing?
Yep. And that's one of the reasons that it's tricky, is that it's not, you know, you can't just like pull a report, right? You can't mm-hmm. just like press button and spit it out. A couple ways to do it. If you're a B2C company, you'll see evidence of your talk trigger show up online mostly. You'll see it in social. You'll see it in ratings and review sites,
right,
et cetera. You'll see evidence of it for most consumer brands. On the B2B side, less likely for that to happen. And in all cases, the best way to do it is with customer survey work. So you interview a percentage of all customers who have had access to the talk trigger, and you ask them three questions. First question is, have you told anybody about our business? If yes, what did you tell them? And what you're looking for is a mention of the talk trigger. Mm-hmm. Third question is a list of 7 items. One of those items is the talk trigger. And you say, did you mention any of these things? Because then you have both aided and unaided results on that question. Mm-hmm. So that's how we do it. We do follow-up surveys, 3-question surveys of customers to determine what we call the talkability rate of your differentiator.
Well, you're defining it's been a metric for the longest time to be able to understand how people are even experiencing and how they're recommending you to a neighbor. But it is a huge influencer impact, and it is when you're looking for consumer advocates, just to be able to have somebody talking about you as a brand and how you are special. It blows away any type of efficiency focus. So you still have to be there, but my gosh, what an incredible and somewhat sometimes easy way to really disrupt and bring on a whole nother level of loyalty, right?
That's the idea. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, let me ask you this. Not that I want to end on this, but how many times do talk triggers fail?
I don't know. I wouldn't have data on that, but they fail for 2 reasons. There's 3 reasons. They fail because they're just not talkable enough, but you'll learn that if you test it, as you should. They sometimes learn because your competitors co-opt it. Like, you may remember that Zappos essentially pioneered free 2-way shipping, mm-hmm. and now everybody has free 2-way shipping. So it's not a talk trigger for anybody anymore. And sometimes that happens. And then sometimes the world changes around you. Like you may remember that Enterprise Rent-A-Car had a talk trigger for a long time, which was, we'll pick you up.
Yep.
They would have somebody come pick you up. That was a really great talk trigger until Uber. now I can get anybody to pick me up. So why do I need the weird rental car guy to do that? So, you know, sometimes the world changes around you and it doesn't work anymore, but that's okay. You just go back to the drawing board and pick a different one.
Absolutely. Well, we certainly want our audience to jump over there and pick up the book. It's a huge, huge, already a really strong success. What are you seeing from the early sales? I mean, are you seeing some buzz that's happening?
Yeah, lots of buzz about the book, a ton, and it's selling very, very strong. TalkTriggers.com is the official site, and there's tons and tons and tons and tons of free stuff there. PowerPoint presentations, infographics, research reports, videos, book discussion group guides, like all kinds of free stuff there. Also, I should tell you that the book itself has a talk trigger, as you might suspect. One, the book has alpacas on the cover, which is weird. And two, on the back, it says satisfaction guaranteed. If you bought this book and didn't like it, go to TalkTriggers.com and send the authors a note, and they will buy you any other book of your choosing. And that's true. So if you don't like it, go to the site, let me know, and Daniel and I will buy you any book you want. You want a first edition Bible, we will figure it out. So there's quite literally no reason to not buy the book. If you don't like it, we'll take care of it.
In Hebrew.
Whatever you want.
So if you've been eyeballing a particular book that's just out of reach, go ahead and buy Talk Triggers, right?
Right.
Oh, no, they're going to love it. Yeah. What a great twist. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Talk Trigger.
Doctor, absolutely. Well, we always love having you on the show, and we certainly don't. We want to split the difference and get you back on soon. Do you have another book in the future that you're going to be releasing?
Not yet, but I'm sure there'll be one someday.
Absolutely. We certainly can bet on that. At the end of every show, we want to ask our guests what really bugs them about the industry right now. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, I think I can only answer this one way, which is to say I sure do miss Google Plus.
Well done, sir. Well done.
You tee it up and I'll just knock it out of the park, boys.
That was fantastic. conversely... What excites you about the digital marketing industry right now?
I really like that there is a renewed focus on storytelling, right? I think we're starting to move past a little bit of the tactical conversation about, you know, where do I click and how do I do this and how should this be formatted and what time should I send it and all that stuff, right? All the blocking and tackling and X's and O's. And more about, well, what are we actually saying? Like, what stories are we telling? Why do consumers care? That's certainly part of the reason why we wrote this book right now. But I like that. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to have something to say. And if you don't have something to say, the mechanics of where and how you say it is kind of immaterial.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing seeing the pendulum swing back to the art of storytelling as well. And then the number of interviews that we've had over the course of the last 6 months, we're seeing that, seeing some really good practitioners. Jay, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. We certainly recommend our audience check out your podcast as well as the books. Utility's been fantastic. Hug Your Haters is a great book. But this one is something you want to bring to the CEO and say, hey, This is where we go. So certainly go over to TalkTriggers.com, right?
You got it, TalkTriggers.com.
All righty. Well, Jay, thank you so much, and we'll catch up with you again. We wish you all the best, and thank you for contributing into this space and educating both the digital market, the marketers, as well as some of our clients as well. It's been fantastic.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate you. Take care.
More welcome. More than welcome. All right. That's a wrap for this episode of Edge of the Web. Special thank you to our colleagues at Site Strategics, as well as our guest, Jay Baer. Make sure you check out all the must-see videos over at edgeofthewebradio.com. That's edgeofthewebradio.com. We're going to be talking to you next week. Tom, who's on deck next
week? We are off next week, Aaron.
We are off next week.
We are. Yes, we were going to have our show on a Tuesday. next week, but we have a conflicting event. So we're off next week.
Oh, that's right.
And then the next week we will have an interview with another special guest.
That's
and
right.
Then we'll follow up that canceled interview with two the following week.
I kind of screwed up the entire works, didn't I?
That's all right.
Well, you guys get a week sabbatical, and then we're back at it. So we actually have Jay Acunzo coming up here soon as well.
Yep.
All right. So from all of us over at Site Strategies, thanks so much for listening. Be sure to rate and review the show. We certainly would love to have your opinions and give us a shout because if you've got somebody that we should be unpacking and interviewing, I don't want to unpack them. But anyway, if you want us to talk to somebody, just drop us a line. We'd be happy to connect with them. So for all of us over at Site Strategies, thanks so much. Do not be a piece of cyber driftwood. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.